It's 12:45 PM, October 27, 2015. This is the in-person interview of Pathways in Education. The Board and Technical Review Panel appreciate that you've come today. We understand that the application process requires time, effort, and intensive commitment, and we wish to thank you for your interest in providing quality educational choices to the children of Arizona. The purpose of this interview is for the applicant to demonstrate how well they understand and have thought through the plan presented in the written application. The interview panel will use the responses to the questions to evaluate the capacity of the applicant to successfully implement the plan to operate a high-quality charter school. We'll start with the introduction of the interview panel.
Good afternoon. My name is Doug Thaman. I'm the Executive Director for the Missouri Charter Public School Association, and this is my third year also serving on technical review panels for the Arizona Charter School Board.
Good afternoon. My name is Susan Chan. I am the Executive Director of Kingman Academy of Learning. We are an original charter school in the state of Arizona, and I have also been involved with this process with the State Board for 3 years.
And again, my name is Joanna Medina. I'm the Assistant Director of Academic Affairs here at the Charter Board, and also facilitated the review of the written application package. At the end is Melissa Fields, who's also a staff member here at the Charter Board, and she'll be doing the recording and taking notes during this interview. Next, I will go over the details of today's interview, and following that, I would like to give the applicant team the opportunity to introduce themselves, which will be followed by your opening statement. This interview will last 90 minutes. I'll now review the procedures and ground rules for the interview process. You'll be given 5 minutes for introductions. We'll extend it just a little bit more because you're a much larger group, and another 5 minutes to make your opening statement. Melissa will cue you when you have 1 minute remaining, and then when all of the minutes are up. Expect to spend 2 to 3 minutes on the initial response to a question, allowing time for any follow-up questions made by the interview panel. Designate a primary respondent for each question, and please feel free to ask for any clarification. In order to give you the opportunity to respond to all of our questions, we will alert you to the amount of time that has passed during your response. We may ask you to move on and give you the opportunity to address any other responses in your closing statement. When 10 minutes remain in the interview period, you will be asked to make a closing statement of no more than 5 minutes. I will conclude the interview with a description of the next steps and details about the final decision-making process. Does anyone have any questions about the procedure or ground rules for this interview? Please introduce your team and include what role each member played in the application process, as well as what role each member intends to have if the charter is approved. You may begin.
My name is Dr. Barbara Duncan. I am the Assistant Superintendent of Charter School Development. My role in the application was to create partnerships and conduct community meetings and assist with the overall application. And if the application is approved, I will assist in continuing in that role of finding resources.
My name is Stephanie Paschke. I am one of the board members. I have had experience with having the privilege of volunteering with other charter schools in the past. I am a business owner and have experience with the city of Phoenix.
I'm Liz Baskerville. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for PMG. I helped in the budget development for the charter application, and should it be approved, I will continue in the financial management of the charter.
My name is Jonathan Morse. I oversee accountability for PMG, and I consulted on the education plan.
My name is Kristen Concepcion. I'm the Curriculum Supervisor for PMG. I wrote the portion of the academic system plans when we discuss how we develop our curriculum. I'll be talking about all portions of the academic systems plan, and if you need any clarification on the A portion of the application, I'll be happy to address that.
My name is Jessica Ray, and I'm the Assistant Superintendent for Pathways Management Group, and I oversaw kind of our leadership plan and professional development for our leadership, as well as our overall growth strategy.
My name is Philip Wilson. I have a diverse background in education. I'm a board member. I assisted in promoting the charter school with the community meeting. I passed out flyers. I spoke at the community meeting that night. I'm currently networking with other charter schools and people in education to develop partnerships. If the charter is approved, I will be an engaged member of the charter and make good choices for us.
My name is Joan Hall. I'm one of the founders of PMG. I'm an officer and I've been involved with many of the schools since 1987.
Hello, my name is Jacob Kim. I'm Deputy General Counsel for PMG. I work with local Arizona Charter School Council and incorporating PI Arizona, as well as getting the governing documents. And I'll continue to work with PI AZ in getting the nonprofit status.
Hi, I'm Christy Hirsch Crumpton. I'm the Director of Online Education. I help devise with the online component. And if we get approved, then that's what I'll be doing, directing the online education.
Hi, my name is Anne Marie Combs, and I also have a diverse background in education. I am an art teacher and school counselor, and I have been instrumental in helping some rollouts of charter schools in North Las Vegas, as well as an elementary school and a high school here in Arizona. And I'm excited to be part of PI Arizona and also a board member.
My name is Greg Marrero. I'm supervisor of school implementation for PMG. I contributed to portions of the academic system plan. And moving forward, if we are approved, I will work with leaders and staff members to for PI Arizona to ensure that the program is being implemented effectively.
Hi, I'm Jill Wells, and I'm the Director of Charter Development. My role in the application was pulling together the pieces from the various experts and putting them together, and I've helped write the application. If the charter is approved, I'll be supporting Dr. Duncan in developing further partnerships and laying the groundwork for community engagement.
My name is Erica Robertson. I'm the General Manager for Prep for Success, and I provide consultation for the special education portion to PI. Whatever they need as far as special education, I support them.
Okay, next, please follow with your opening statement.
Okay, Fifth Arrow Charter School proposes to serve students in Central East Phoenix. We look to go to the area of most need, and we have found they're plagued with poor educational outcomes, high poverty, high crime, high teenage pregnancy rates. There are few similar schools in the area that serve this population. Of the seven schools that are there, there are only two that have received a letter grade above a C for accountability measures. We've also found that there was a study done nationwide for disconnected youth, that is youth who are not in school and are not in work, ages 16 to 24, and Phoenix was the number one location at 18.8%. With disconnected youth. So we definitely said this is an area we want to focus on for our program, which is a high-performing, research-based model with over 30 years of experience serving this population. The mission of our school is to serve students who are at risk of dropping out of high school or who have dropped out of high school, to empower and inspire them to achieve their high school diploma as well as their post-secondary dreams for college and career opportunities. Our specific model, it has unique features. We have a blended learning model, which entails small group instruction, guided independent study, online instruction, as well as direct one-on-one instruction. We have a full 240-day year-round curriculum with continuous enrollment. We have a transformational experiential learning program for our students, as well as wraparound mental health and educational services. A strong parent involvement, community involvement component, coupled with college and career opportunities with an individualized education plan for each and every student. This year, Pathways Education was considered for the prestigious Broad Prize for Urban Education, as well as received the Bronze Award for U.S. News for high-performing high schools in regard to student assessments on state tests and college opportunities. Now I would just like to ask Stephanie to give our core values. Fifth Arrow's core values are based on an individual learning approach, coupled with creating an environment of strong personal relationships. Through this foundation, we empower and re-engage students to develop grit, resilience, optimism, and gratitude, to take responsibility for their own learning and become productive citizens of their community.
Great, thank you very much. Again, I want to thank you for all for being here and for your time and the work that you've done thus far in preparing this application. We have a series of questions that we are going to work through. We have all read your application, studied it with a lot of detail, and looking forward to hearing your responses. Dr. Duncan, I think I will probably most part direct questions to you, and then if there are others,
sure.
you can ask them to respond instead of trying to figure out who's talking about what. I do want to just call your attention to the fact that we are all taking notes, using our laptops. If we're not looking at you, it's not that we're disinterested, we're just trying to get as much information down as possible. So let's start with just the description of a typical day for a student in the life of at Fifth Arrow, and what put a little emphasis on what is it about the school culture that makes it a little different?
Perfect. Justin, I'm going to ask Kristen.
So there is a variation of the typical school day, because one thing that is unique to our school is that we design the students' plan to graduation based on their specific needs. So some of our students will come to us far behind in their credits, and so we will give them an assessment when they start, and based on what they grade on their assessment, we design what classes they should be in. So if a student comes to us and they're behind and they take our initial assessment and show that they're below in reading and math, most likely their day would consist of their meeting with their guided independent study teacher, as well as two small group instruction classes. Our small group instruction that's outlined in our application is most like your traditional classroom. However, within that class, there would only be 10 to 15 students. So say student A comes to school at 9:00 in the morning. He could meet with his teacher from 9 to 10. This would be the time that they reflect on the student's individual learning plan, talk about anything in their academics that they're struggling with, they need to review, prep for with their assessments, and just how they're doing in our program. Then say from 10:00 to either 11:30 or 12, based on the small group instruction class, they would be in a cohort class with their peers studying math or English. And then in the afternoon, perhaps come back for either their other math or English class. So throughout the day, they would have met with at least three teachers every time that they come to our appointment. Now, if they're a student that has SGI classes, say on Tuesdays and Thursdays, it is possible that if a student has special needs or an EL learner that needs more support, they may meet with their general education teacher on Monday and Wednesday from say 9 to 10, 10 to 11. We have hourly appointments, and then be scheduled for tutoring or intervention based on their specific needs and participate in SGI classes on the opposite days. Then I know a large portion of our application deals with online classes as well. So depending on the amount of support they need in the online classes, they may be completing a lot of their online classes on site, so they have help in person. However, if it's a student that comes to us with medical needs, their school day might look completely different, because if they have to remain home for any health issues, a larger portion of their school day would be online. So we could definitely give you a typical day, but since our students aren't always typical, there will be variation.
Thank you.
So what is going to make the difference in your success with students? In other words, what sets your school apart from other public schools?
Sorry, I'll answer a lot of your questions. So what sets us apart is we are great at finding out what students are missing in their past education and then designing our program to meet their specific needs. So We will stand apart because of the amount of attention that we give to every single student. When they come in, we just don't look at their transcripts and plop them into a class and say, this is your grad requirements. We have honest discussions, like, for instance, why weren't you successful up until this point? What about your previous school did you not feel comfortable with? We get a whole variety of students. Some come to us because they've had trouble in their previous schools, and some with anger issues or been expelled. Others come because they just never really fit into the traditional high school. So we truly believe that in order for us to create the best plan for them, we need to understand their post-secondary goals, but also what has led them up to this point in their education. And because of our school-wide commitment to finding that out about each and every student, we have tremendous success, and the students know that they are cared for individually.
I think that all comes from an asset-based approach too. So it's a lot of times when a student transfers to a school, the first thing that's looked at is that discipline record, or how many Fs they may have, or how far behind they are. But this comes from a place of counseling and of identifying what is needed academically, social emotionally, but also what is needed even in from a cognitive psychology perspective for that student to believe that they are capable and to re-engage them in their education. So what, and that might look different for each student. Some students come and they are engaged in their education, they just didn't fit into that traditional model. And some are highly disengaged, and it's going to take a period of time where their teacher is going to really work with them in order to basically kind of reignite that passion within them for whatever their goals are for their future, as well as reignite that passion and then also connect them with their dream. And so that's going to come from that one-on-one relationship that they build with that primary teacher.
So please share with us information regarding the school's social studies program.
Our social studies program is pretty typical of an average high school. Now in prepping to come to Arizona, I run the curriculum department for out of state. So the first step that my curriculum developers do is we will compare the standards of current states that we're in to Arizona to make sure that we could recognize if we have an established like world history or US history, what standards are the same here as in California to guarantee that we meet all Arizona standards. One thing that is unique to our social studies program is that, or I would hope that it's not so unique, I'd hope that it happens in more schools, but that we teach social studies, any social science, as this is what happened, this is what we know about it, look for biases, what is the risk that something like this could happen in present time. So if they're looking at conflicts throughout the world, we not only talk about, well, this leader disagreed with this leader and they went to war, we don't teach it from a press release point of view, we teach it from so that the students have an understanding of what the people in the community went through during experiences and how the effects of war and poverty and governments fighting, how that matriculates down to the population. So it's more of like from a self-empowerment perspective, because we all hear like, oh, why do I have to study history? So we explain to them like, you have to study, you do not want to be in the same situation in the future. And our social science developers are quite passionate in what they write, and they are committed to bringing like a people's perspective to social science.
Is this mostly done online, your social studies curriculum?
We offer curriculum online. However, in our guided independent study curriculum, we offer it in workbooks. And the team that I manage develops all the guided independent study curriculum. So depending on the needs of the school, usually you could either take social science through guided independent study or online. But if we recognize that there's a group of students that are struggling with certain aspects of history, we sometimes will offer like a Friday workshop to talk about World War II and
I know that a while back we were doing a lesson on World War I, and we built trenches inside the school that the students had to go through, and with like fake rats and blood, and like not real blood obviously, but we to make it engaging. If a student is bored and we're studying World War I, like we take it as a challenge, like, okay, how am I going to hook that kid and how am I going to make them interested in that? So there's a big variety in our instructional delivery.
And we've also, in many of our schools, had social science small group instructors as well. But we tend to primarily have small group instruction in the areas of math, English, and science, because that's where we see the biggest holes in skill growth and in meeting.
In the application, you talk about utilizing benchmark assessments summatively. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what you mean by using, how you use those benchmark assessments in a summative fashion?
I could explain it some from a teaching point of view, and then Jonathan could back me up because he would be talking more about the benchmarks as far as state benchmarks. I know it was referenced that we use them more summatively. My team will use them more for formative assessment. So if I don't answer your question completely, Jonathan will be happy to do so. In our small group instruction classes, we will offer a benchmark after 2/5 of the class is complete, and then for semester 1, and then at the same portion for semester 2, and then we'll use that as a summative assessment of our performance when we're redesigning the class to be offered the next time. And then I think you could answer it then better than me as far as summative.
Well, when we talk about summative assessments, using these benchmark assessments summatively, which sort of sounds like a contradiction in terms a little bit, you can glean information like if the student's growth is negative. The student is obviously, if they are doing their work and we see that they're attending school and they're attending classes and they're doing their work and they're still getting negative results, usually that is an indicator of lack of engagement. And so I try to make sure, well, I don't try, Jessica requests reports regularly on students that are getting negative growth. And so that's one way we use it summatively, where we show the principals and the teachers, hey, these students, there's obviously an issue here where the student isn't taking they're not taking the test seriously. And so we look at, I hope that's the kind of example that we're looking for. Does that sort of answer your question?
So in by summative, you mean not that it is and I don't want to put words in your mouth, so if I misstate this, tell me. It's not summative for the student. It's more of a summative report for the staff to address student needs.
That's the way I would characterize it, yes.
So just a little bit more on your summative assessments. How will summative assessments be used to monitor what needs to be done to best address student needs?
Well, summative assessments will follow. We'll have a summative assessment at the end of each semester, and then again at the end of the year. And we will use that to gauge our effectiveness in helping the students reach their learning goals. So if we have perfect attendance and students at school every day, like we don't pat ourselves on the back that all our students are meeting their learning goals. We wait until we get all the data from our summative assessments to then inform our instruction and see what adjustments we need to make for the following year. One benefit of having a curriculum department and our SGI coaches is that we are able to take that data and make changes right away to continually improve our program.
If I could just piggyback on that as well.
Yeah.
disaggregate the data as the data allows, and we connect the data to the information in our student information system. And we try to break down are the students that are doing the best on, I'm going to use the high school exit exam in California, are the students that are performing the best on the high school exit exam, were they part of an SGI cohort? How did those students in particular do? Students that took state assessment in science, when we look at the types of courses that the students who performed the best versus the students who need the most improvement, what kind of courses did they take? What was their average attendance? What kind of grades did they get on their unit tests? We try to break things down in a very macro sort of way. So I can tell you all that offhand that on the Casey, all of our achievement gap kids outperform the state of California as a whole in every single category for our California schools. But I can also tell you that the most effective SGI courses were that we used in the state of California for those kids that made the greatest gains. So we try to make things part of a best practices conversation when Jessica has the conversations at the year end with her principals and vice principals.
So I think this question gets to the variety that you have in your students. How will you approach the sometimes complex issues that these students who have an IEP or multiple diagnoses?
How do we support them?
Excuse me. How would you approach a student that does come to you with an IEP and has had multiple diagnoses?
The support that we can provide it to Pathways is when a student comes in with the IEP, we review it. At their orientation, we do the 30-day admin placement so that we can provide whatever services listed in their IEP, schedule their appointments with the special education teacher and any other related service provider. And then through that 30 days, we evaluate what accommodations are listed in their IEP, how we can apply that to the program that they're in, so whether they're doing the SGIs, whether they're doing online, the SGI classes, infant study, whatever. We provide those services, and then after 30 days, we evaluate what services are needed to continue the success of the student, whether it's online or whether it's the infant study program or SGI.
So I'd like to take that a step further. That's what I've heard you describe as the traditional special education process. I'm guessing that your students come with a lot of other complex issues tied into being a special education student or including their diagnosis. How does the school address all of those complex
issues? I was going to address this, but I wasn't sure if that was part of what you were asking. So usually if a student comes to us with an IEP, those aren't the only things in school that they're struggling with. So as a part of the orientation, when we meet with the parents and the students, and if the student has an IEP also with the special education teacher, we discuss the difficulties in learning based on their IEPs, but then we also discuss whether this has affected the student's own confidence in themselves as a learner, if any of these struggles have caused the student to act in a violent way or feel negative about themselves or any learning environment. One thing that we can't ignore is really the level of parenting that they've had. So if we have a student with an IEP who requires a lot of support, and when we meet the parents, see that the parents maybe aren't super engaged in the student's learning, us as a team try to think, okay, how can we personally serve the student's need if they're not going to have a lot of participation from the parents. Unfortunately, that's something we run into. And then we also while considering the students, like, have their emotional feelings at school, we never want them to stand out as an IEP student. So we're very careful in the classes that we place the student in, obviously the least restrictive environment and what is most appropriate for them to learn. But also, if I have a student, I had a student with a severe stutter, and I made sure that in the class I placed them by another student that I know was a kind student and wouldn't tease that student because of the stutter. So we pay attention to their emotional needs as well as their learning needs, and do our best to design their individual learning based on what they come to us with. Some of that we get to know a little better as they stay with us longer, and luckily a lot of the emotional components of our students with IEPs improves over time. Since they're working with the independent study teacher a lot, this is an adult that they're meeting with a minimum of twice a week, who is constantly asking them, how's your day? How are you doing in your classes? Is there anything you'd like to talk about? And we have found that even a student that comes to us with very poor behavior, after a couple months in our program, we really see it turn in it because of our individual attention. So we try to serve the whole student in the best way possible.
What about your students who are English language learners?
Yeah, we have a tremendous amount of English language learners. I was surprised by Phoenix Unified School District that it's only a 5% English language learner population. I would suspect, like we have in California, we have our percentage of English language learners, but I think that we have a lot of students that are English language learners that just haven't been identified. The first thing that we do is we send home our, you know, your standard home language survey. If it's indicated that English is not spoken at home, we will administer your English language development test. The Arizona English language development test is very similar to the California test, where it's addressing reading, writing, it's speaking, and we, based on the results that we have, if we have their results from a previous school, then we send that information to our English language development specialists that provide guidance through PMG for our schools. We also train our teachers in how to work with English language development students. We have found we have the most success with our English language students by setting a pretty set schedule. So they'll meet with their teachers. They could also have an opportunity to meet with the English language development specialist that helps them through their schoolwork. And most importantly, or maybe not most importantly, but we build relationships with the parents and bring them into the students' education. So a lot of times we found that if there wasn't someone who could speak to the parents, it was hard to get students involved in some of the extra interventions for English language development. So we make sure to have an open dialect with our parents of our English language learners. For a typical English language learner, depending on what level of proficiency they're at, it's our goal for them to definitely test out and be English language proficient. But depending on what they show in both their SGI classes and on the English language development assessment, we will have extra tutoring, extra time with their independent study teacher, any resources that we assess are necessary.
And finally, how about students who are homeless or at risk of academic failure?
I can talk to the enrollment process, and then I'll hand it over to Kristen about what actually happens. But anytime we receive a student that we identify as homeless, we follow all the rules for McKinney-Vento, and we enroll the student right away, regardless of transcripts or shot records or anything like that. we make sure that the student has all the supplies that they need to function in school. And then we will do the investigative work with any previous districts, in-state or out-of-state. We'll talk to the student, talk to the parent if the parent is in the picture or a guardian. And we'll make sure that the student is given at least a good start into our program, but they are immediately enrolled into school.
I think another just thing to point out is that because of the nature of our school model and the way it's set up, and that there is that individualized attention, and the fact that every student is on an IEP, it's actually an incredibly supportive environment for our homeless students, because ultimately we are advocates for within their education, but also in whatever other needs and support services and wraparound services they may need. In Chicago, one of our school sites there has about a 20% homeless and transient population, and we've done a lot to provide them with wraparound services and support services and work within the community to make sure that we can connect them with shelters and with drug counseling, with, you know, pregnant or parenting teen counseling, anything that they need, as well as we actually just, I think it's only been about a week or so, shipped out a lot of backpacks that were full of just a lot of, you know, school supplies and gift cards and different things that can help support them. And so those actually went out pretty recently.
What are those plans for professional development?
So with our professional development program, we provide an intensive two-week induction program for any new employees who come on board. It's broken into five modules. Module one would deal with learning our education model, school structure, school culture. Module two teaches about effective strategies for working with diverse populations and specific course and curriculum needs. Module three addresses specific needs of ELs, students with disabilities, students who are working at below grade level, following and supporting students with IEPs, and also works with our students our teachers to learn how to facilitate our online program. And then module four talks about our instructional equity initiative, which really helps our teachers to learn how to close their achievement gap, setting and holding high expectations, and using data to drive instruction. In addition to that, we do a fifth module after about 3 months that sort of ties together the actual on-the-ground experiences that the students have had to reinforce the learning and to talk about different holding high expectations for our particular students. In addition to that, we also provide professional learning communities every Friday for our teachers. Those could entail taking a look at student progress, different forms of data to help to drive instruction or to address specific needs of a specific population of students.
And how do you ensure that those processes are being implemented at your schools, for instance, the PLCs, or the implementation of the strategies that you present in your PD topics?
Okay, so part of that is PMG provides implementation experts will come out, will ensure that the program is being implemented the way that it is meant to do, working specifically with the principal in order to ensure that they are targeting the specific indicators that will ensure that the students are making satisfactory progress.
If I could add to that, a lot of what we do to back up our professional development comes with follow-up. We found that if we offer professional development and then never return to it with our teachers, that they might be gung-ho for about a week, but then we're going to lose the effectiveness of what's shared with them. So our students come to us already, or our parents come, our teachers come to us already highly qualified. So you'll notice that a lot of our professional development is very specific to how to treat our student population with specific needs. And so once we implement this professional development, a lot of the skills that will be taught in here will then be a part of the teacher evaluation that Greg could speak to more later when the principal is observing the teacher. So we want to make sure that the teachers understand, teachers and staff understand the professional development, have time to work through what has been taught in the professional development, and then that we return to that information to make sure that it's being implemented properly and to make sure that they fully understand.
And if I can, Greg referenced the implementation team. I think this, I can give a little explanation of that, but I think supports the concept of professional development. One thing that we found as we opened up schools in outside of California, Chicago, Memphis, Tennessee, and Shreveport, Louisiana, is that school startup is tough for any school, and especially for a school that is, you know, miles away from a lot of the support or the community of a lot of schools that are together in California. And so one thing that we did to combat that was develop an implementation team. And their whole goal is to support new school leaders through those first crucial years to make sure that school culture and school values are being replicated and maintained, and that there is ongoing training, ongoing professional development. They're helping that school leader identify what the holes may be or whether or not they are using data in the most effective way to really drive instruction and drive student academic results. And they're also helping me with behind the scenes, everything that it takes to understand a new state and what policy and working with the authorizing district and all of, and ed code, and all the things that really are a lot within those first few years of a new school for a school leader that really needs to just focus on staff and students. And so that is a team that we have in place that really supports for first crucial years, and then scales back their support as that school leader establishes themselves.
So in the application, it focuses primarily on teacher professional development, but we do have a framework to provide professional development at every level for our staff in the schools.
So how many implementation teams do you have?
We have a ratio that we've established. Right now we have two supervisors of school implementation, and we have one director that helps with a lot of operations and things like that. So again, the school leaders can focus on instruction. And so Greg is one of the supervisors of school implementation. He supports our Memphis, Tennessee school. And one of the other reasons why we found that this was needed, and it speaks to something else with our principal fellowship, was that in Chicago, when we first got started, that was 8 years ago, we had a hard time finding a school leader that that really understood our model and our core values, and that wasn't didn't have a district mentality, but also having a school leader that's learning right alongside their team is a struggle for any school leader. And so that was another thing, is the implementation team can support that leader through that learning curve.
Can you please provide more detail regarding the pilot program relative to curriculum and how it is appropriate for Arizona?
I can. So my team will develop individual courses once they have been developed, written, edited. We offer a pilot where we get teachers from usually around 20 teachers to evaluate it, and then we also get students to evaluate it. We do it in two different ways. We have students take the class as if just a regular class, let us know how long it took them to get through each unit, parts they struggled with. parts they found interesting, and most importantly, parts that they thought were totally boring. And we want to know if our curriculum is engaging them. And then also if it prepared, if the activities and lessons prepare them to be successful on the assessments. And if there was a big enough variety of assessments to gauge student learning, but not using a written test. So we'll include projects, speeches, debate sometime to see if they were able to demonstrate their mastery if we gave them enough opportunities to. So that would be the student part of the pilot. Then teachers pilot it in different ways. Some of the teachers are in charge of those students who are taking the pilot, and they make notes based on the student feedback that they're receiving. Also, if our instruction manual was thorough enough that they felt supported while offering the class, if the training that we provided on the class was thorough enough for them to implement the class successfully. And then we have a group of teachers that take the class as if they're students. So then we compare their notes to our group of students taking notes and get all of that data together and look for holes. And we actually make it as fun as possible in challenging developers. Okay, this lesson was super boring. You didn't interest any kid. The standard's important. How are we going to do it? And then we use that information, the feedback from our pilots, to make improvement to the classes before we roll them out to the field. Now, once we roll them out to the field, sometimes we'll get information from the field that we didn't get during the pilot. So we're always available and interested in how the teachers and students in the field are responding to our curriculum. So teachers are able to contact us directly, tell us any problems they're having with the curriculum, and then we meet as needed to address and make improvements to our curriculum. So our pilot process is pretty thorough.
Okay, so you are using current students and teachers to run a pilot for courses that'll be held in Arizona?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, we wouldn't like your, we, let me correct that. So English and math would be fine to pilot in Arizona. If we have a history class that our standards are not the same and don't cover the California standards, we would never pilot that with like a group of kids in California that aren't gonna benefit fully from that. We would then pilot, if it's a class that we're developing that's Arizona specific, we would do the teacher pilot first and then make improvements as needed once we open doors in Arizona. One class in particular, and it's not mentioned by name in the application, but we have a career readiness class, and we develop that for each state individually. And it has things throughout about just being responsible, preparing for college, stuff like that. But then we also like to bring in whatever the local industry is in the states that we're going into. So we would write that class before we open the doors in Arizona. But based on the feedback from the students that first year, we would make improvements to that class. That's one good thing about having our curriculum department is we always have the opportunity to improve our curriculum when we see a need.
And that's the second half of the question. How do you approach revising the curriculum as necessary and at least twice annually?
We actually do it more than twice annually. I'm in pretty good contact with the principals, and believe me, our principals have no problem contacting me if they feel that there's places in the curriculum that we can make improvements. So we do formal meetings of all of our curriculum every 3 months and mention all the feedback that we've received from principals. But as I get emails from principal, my team is on site. So I walk in, have a discussion with my team. This is what we're said. This is what was said, please read this section, let me know your thoughts on it, and let's start brainstorming ways to fix it. So we have like formal meetings to discuss it, but it's also an ongoing conversation.
So please describe your process for evaluating instructional practices.
So we actually, instructional practices. So we would have at least two formal observations per year with each teacher. We have a model, we've modified the Danielson model to fit into our program. So what we're looking at would be student participation and engagement, student attendance and parent communication, student engagement, student support outcomes, instructional practices, lesson planning, and classroom data. Again, that's done at least twice a week, a year with each one of our teachers. And that's performed by either the small group instruction coach or by the principal, or a combination of both.
And just for clarification, Greg was speaking more of the teacher evaluation of our instruction. Is that what you were fully looking for, or also how we look at our instruction model in comparison to our students?
So it's about understanding your process for evaluating the classroom instruction that's going on, and you know what the teachers are doing.
Okay.
Which, yes.
Okay, so I think that Greg answered it, but if you'd like any more clarification, we could add to it.
My follow-up to that, so you said that this is done twice throughout the year?
Those are the formal observations that are done. The principal would be, throughout the entire year, is also performing informal observations, providing teachers with feedback. Again, that harkens back to the PLCs that we are having every Friday, so that if there are specific deficiencies that are apparent, the principal can address those with those professional learning communities in order to make adjustments to the program.
And just to kind of piggyback on that as well, we take very careful measurements in terms of the students' work output, because with an independent study, guided independent study, blended sort of model, it can be difficult to gauge students' engagement in the learning process. And one of the metrics that we look at day by day, literally day by day and week by week, is the students' credit attainment rates. We want to make sure that they're always on track, on the track that the teacher and the student and the parent have agreed the speed at which that they need to attain credits to get to their graduation goals. And so there's a lot that informs that process of continuous instructional improvement based on the information. I don't like to use the word data, because data is very sort of hard to understand, but we try to provide teachers, school leaders, and the implementation teams with actionable, hard information that gives them a direction to go, so that they're not constantly having to break data down. We're hopefully giving them access to the information that they need to make decisions, in addition to providing them data sets as needed. So I just wanted to.
One thing our application alludes to, but I think it's kind of hard to put it in writing, is when we discuss the PLCs, the teachers in our schools are encouraged to observe each other, not like in a tattletale way, but like, please come to my class, let me know if you have any pointers, pay attention to my students, see if they're engaged. Watch the students more than you watch the teacher, because that's where you're gonna get your true information. And then when they have their PLCs on Friday, a lot of times they'll bring student work examples, they'll evaluate it. And then also, what did you notice in my teaching? What suggestions can you give? So the teachers, the culture of the teachers is really collaborative in how to improve their instruction. And it's an ongoing process with our teachers, but they are encouraged to constantly self-evaluate, but then also to take advice from their peers, their coaches, and the principals.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there. We're coming on close to about an hour. I want to make sure we have plenty of time for the other part. So, sorry. So let's want to move into talking about the operational plan. So if you could share with us how enrollment is handled and kind of talk about your initial enrollment with us.
So I to Kristen. Sorry, I prior to joining the curriculum team, I was a center coordinator, small group instruction, and a teacher. So I enrolled students for 2 years. And when a student comes to us, usually it starts with a phone call from the parent or guardian looking for a proper placement for their student. So we start with a conversation explaining our program. Then the students bring in the required documentation, like proof of residency, just your standard documentation. We could go into that more if you'd like. And then also we go over our master agreement with them, and that's our expectations of the students who participate at our school, as well as our expectations to serve the needs of our parents and students. Once we go over all of that and the paperwork is submitted, students are scheduled for an orientation. The orientations usually have multiple students, and this is where the staff explains the culture of our school, explains our individual learning plan, and then also we have our special education teachers there as well. So if any of the students that are new to enrollment have IEPs, they have the opportunity for their parents to talk to our special education teachers at the time. After the group orientation, the students are split up where they meet with their independent study teachers and discuss their schedule and their plan, and then make further appointments as designated by that meeting.
So when classes are full, how are students selected?
When our small,
we get on a lottery list. And so another thing that I think is really key about our school model is that there is continuous enrollment. So rather than there being enrollment windows, a student can enroll with us on any day of the year, as long as space is available, which is, you know, really, really powerful for students that are transient or that have moved around a lot. So they can start and get the classes that they need and the support they need on the day that they want to enroll, especially also with students that are at risk or disengaged. Sometimes they will have a moment where they are engaged, and then if they have to wait on a wait list or a lottery list, then suddenly they're not engaged anymore. And so being able to get them engaged when they're seeking school, I think, can also make a big difference.
And the advantage of our blended school model is that if a student is enrolling in the middle of a semester, we're able to place them into an independent study course and an online course, and then when they need their, like, a small group instruction class, when the next one opens up in several weeks, they're able to then participate in that as well. So we can engage the student from the very beginning in several different courses because of the structure of our model, the blended model.
How and for what purpose will teachers be evaluated?
So our evaluation, we look at a teacher evaluation. We do it on an annual basis. We look at job knowledge, the quality of the student work, quantity, or the progress towards graduation during the completion. Professionalism and helping students to achieve their goals. Those are based upon each student's specific individual needs as laid out in their ILPs, their individual learning plans. So that is really how we will assess the effectiveness of our teachers. Again, that goes back to we'll be looking at some of the data points that Jonathan alluded to as far as the unit completion. We will also look at the skills growth for those particular students. So the students upon enrollment will take a benchmark assessments, the Renaissance Star, and they'll take that at, upon enrollment, and then at the end of, or at, during the spring semester, so we can measure skills growth in both reading and math.
And why do you evaluate teachers? What is your purpose in evaluation?
To ensure that students are learning. So if the students are not, if we have a teacher who is on board and the students are not making the satisfactory progress that we need to make sure that we are able to provide the additional support training so that those teachers are able to support the students in the way that they need to be supported.
And if I can just piggyback, I think the intention of the PLCs is to make sure that research-based strategies are being implemented. So because we do that on a weekly basis, we come to the evaluation times, you know, the expectation is that those strategies are being implemented and we're seeing that happening. So that's what's going to drive the instruction and produce student learning.
And although we do an annual, a formal annual review throughout each one of our learning periods throughout the school year, the teacher is able to give informal feedback to each of those teachers to ensure that they are they're meeting their monthly goals, so that it's not, we don't go an entire year with that teacher not understanding that they haven't been meeting the progress goals that are necessary in order to ensure effective teaching.
I can also say from a special ed standpoint, is we, for our special ed teachers, we have them submit a monthly report on how the students are performing. So if we have a teacher whose students, like the overall caseload or a particular student is not progressing, that we intervene to see if the student needs more services or if the school psychologist needs to get involved or whatever may need happen, that we track the performance of the special ed students separately from what the general program does.
So this question is for the education service provider. How will you evaluate Pathways in Education Arizona, or Fifth Arrow?
We will evaluate and measure kind of the growth quality based on several different things. One key goal for us, not only is that they meet their the accountability framework that is agreed upon with our chartering district, but also that the school has accredited attainment of above 80%, and that continues to increase, so that students are making progress, and that we, for skill growth on STAR, we see a 5% increase in reading and a 3% increase in math. From the very start, one way that we measure growth quality is on enrollment numbers, so our students coming, and then also student retention and graduation rates, but then also, you know, looking at positive relationship with our contracting or charter district and student and parent satisfaction, as well as leadership and teacher buy-in. And those are usually done through surveys.
So in Exhibit B31, in front of you, you provide the passing rate percentage for 10th grade students on the state assessment. For example, options for Youth Burbank, you indicate 87% of 10th grade students achieved a passing rate in ELA in 2011 and 12. Can you talk about your rationale for providing that single subgroup piece of data as opposed to combined grade level proficiency rates? For example, the options for Youth Burbank percentage of proficient in ELA in 2011-12 was 48.2, which was below the state average of 56.3. So rather than giving that whole piece of data, why did you use the 10th grade subgroup piece there?
Are we looking at 3.1, you said?
No.
B3.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking at the wrong.
Okay.
No, we are looking at that.
Oh, I'm looking at the exhibit. I apologize. We We looked at the grade 10 passing rate because the grade 11 and grade 12 passage rates are difficult to measure simply because students have multiple opportunities to take the assessment in grades 11 and grade 12. And so in grade 10 in California, the students are only given one opportunity in their grade 10 year to take the CASE. And then in grade 11, they can take it 2 to 3 times, depending on kind of how the calendar falls for the student. And then in grade 12, they can take it up to 4 times. And so passage rates can be inflated unless you're looking at individual passing scores longitudinally for students. So you could have a student, depending on how the state kind of computes the data, a single student could, in a single year, count as 3 negative outcomes and 1 positive outcome. So we usually, the short answer is this is the standard practice in the state of California.
Well, this is considered that benchmark is if students are passing the California High School Ex exam on their first opportunity, which is in 10th grade. So these statistics for them to pass on the first time actually shows is more impressive than if, you know, by the time they graduate, we have pretty much 99% of the students pass. And also, if you look right above this charter, Options for Youth Burbank is the charter that was nationally recognized in the U.S. News Best High School. So I think that was another reason why that was specifically presented.
If you would like, I have all the CASE data here, literally on my laptop. I can provide you with those grade by grade passing scores if you would like those. But there were esoteric reasons that we provided it this way that maybe we should have clarified in the application.
Okay, so then you can go with your follow-up.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
So in 2013, 10 of the 12 pathways associated schools in California did not make adequate yearly progress. So what interventions and improvements to the program have occurred to address that low performance?
I can speak to the data. I can't speak to the actual practice in the classrooms, but I know that in certain circumstances, if we're looking at API scores, adequate, are you talking about adequate yearly progress overall or within each subgroup?
Overall per school.
Okay, so for the way California, one of the reasons that they're kind of redoing the API and the AYP system in California is if you didn't meet adequate yearly progress in a particular subgroup, you failed as a whole. So one of the things that we try to do is break everything out to make sure that we understand where the problem areas actually are, where the achievement gaps are getting wider versus narrower. And so one of the things that we found is that Hispanic students, for instance, were growing, their API scores were growing at a faster rate than all other students, and so that's a good indicator. But EL students were growing at only, they were still growing, but they were only growing half as fast. So one of the things we did for EL students in that circumstance is we beefed up our efforts to A, make sure that we're identifying as many of the EL students that are coming to us as possible, but B, making sure that we're redesignating the students if it's required, so that we're actually getting a good data set. In terms of instructionally, I'm going to have to defer to either Greg or Kristen.
Can I jump in on that? Just because I've been with the program for so many years, is that our target audience, for the large part in California, is at-risk students. And so we have students coming in who have lacked in education or engagement in their education. And so they're further behind or they perform lower. And one of the things that the program has done is provided the small group instruction, tutors, special education support, RTI, all of those wraparound supports for the students who are performing below when they come into the program. So one of the things we need to recognize is that we target students who are already performing below average, regardless of being special ed or not, and that the program has been developed all of these wraparound services to support the students so that if they can't do the online, if they can't do the independent study, we have SGI, we have tutors, we have other programs to support them.
I think what you're asking is, what are we doing about those schools to improve them? And so in addition to everything that they're saying, that is where we then sit down with those school leaders and we talk about what additional resources are needed that are gonna make an impact using the data and information that we can get based off of subgroups and things that we can get from the accountability team to say, okay, we need to really do a better job with our EL students, or we really need to figure out a way to engage African American males, whatever it may be. And then from there, it really can get pretty creative at the school level as far as what do you want to do about it, what are you going to do with this data and this information, and what do you need to do it. And then at that point, it kind of speaks again to a PLC sort of environment where we sit down and we say, you know, you need to get your results from X, from Y to Z, and so what is needed, and how can we make sure you get those resources? And so that's been my experience. I've been with the schools for 12 years now, and so that's been my experience every time that we really want to see great gains.
So as a follow-up to that, take one. I want an example. I'm looking for an example of that. This is what we saw on test data. This is what we went to the PLC and talked about. This is what came out of that discussion. This is how it improved student performance.
So I worked. I was a school leader in when we kind of started our Los Angeles region, and I oversaw our Compton, Huntington Park, and Greg actually did for a little while as well, our site that was in South LA, pretty close to USC. And so one area, kind of also a part of that equity initiative was, you know, those were the toughest kids at that point, and we really wanted to make sure that we could show great gains. And so specifically at our Hoover site, which was near USC, we looked at the data. I as a school leader sat down with my teachers and said, what do we need to do to move this needle in our exit exam, in our CASE passage rates, but also even in what courses were being offered. And so I'm going to kind of talk about two things. So one thing we did, we needed to see huge increases in our CASE passage. At that individual site, it was terrible. I'm not going to remember the exact number now. It's been about 6 years, but I think it was like 50%. And we were able to, by coming up with creative strategies of what the teachers want to do to engage students, getting the students more engaged in school, and also we added three more small group instructors to that site so that that more students were able to get into the small group instruction classes. And so pretty much every student, no matter what, was in a class. As well as we added targeted intervention specialists, which were just, there was a man at that time that he was amazing at being able to sit down with a student and identify very specific holes in math that would take lots of diagnostic tests to figure out. And he would target that, and he would work with those students, and he would meet with them twice a week on individual skills to improve that. And so we brought him in to work just with those students. We added more small group instructors, as well as we did a lot of like kind of fun, more fluffy, creative things just to engage the student population. We went from 50% to, I think it was 90% passage rate in 1 year. There's lots of other examples that are smaller, more incremental growth, but that was, it was phenomenal. And then another thing that we, what was I going to say? The other thing that we did there. We also saw that the classes that teachers were assigning students to was making a huge difference. And so, for example, if a student is not engaged, failed a lot of classes prior, a teacher could give them an elective, right? And say, oh, this will be something that can get them really engaged back in school and be kind of fun. We found that is the exact wrong approach. They need to be in a core course. They need to be in algebra from the start. They need to see success in something that they see as hard. And that is also the classes that are going to give them the skills that can that are going to equal student learning. And so we broke down what every class that was being assigned to students to say, are you giving the right courses to basically reinforce the fact that you believe that student can do it, but also to give them, make sure they're, like, you're covering the standards and they're getting the skills in order to learn. So that was a specific site that I was over.
Okay. My next question is, now we're going to transition to the business plan. Why does the ESP amount jump in year three?
In years one and two, we have management fee forgiveness because the school hasn't attained its, like, ideal economic viability. We see that the management company will forgive those fees, so it's not to, allows the money to stay in the instructional program. In year three, once we kind of attain our steady state, it allows us to charge the full 10%.
Also, there's an assumption made that there will be two additional campuses. How will you manage this if for some reason those are not allowed?
Well, obviously, the model's built on a growth assumption. However, should we not get those campuses, then we'll simply hone down or pare down the assumptions, pare down the staffing, so that we can maintain this one site successfully.
So looking at your budget there, what's the lowest enrollment number that would allow you, still make it feasible for you to be able to open?
To be honest, I don't think we've done a pure break-even analysis on this. I know we assume we're getting 250 students out of the gate. We probably could sustain something far less than that. We would just put more resources into marketing and into development to get it there. Usually, I think we like to see at least 100 students. But
so
again, I have run the numbers specifically here, and I haven't done that.
Okay, so 100, you could still open the doors.
Yes, I
below
so.
100.
You know, I don't.
I mean, the
say
per pupil funding rate's different,
yes,
in Arizona than it is in Louisiana. That was the last state that we've opened a school in. So our school in Caddo, which is in Shreveport, opened. We have two sites there now. So it started 2 years ago. We're just starting our second year. And our growth there was, it's a little bit more rural. So it's not LA, it's not Chicago, and our growth there was a little bit slower. I wouldn't expect that it would be the case here to be, because that is more rural than Phoenix. But we've had about 25 students a month. So it took us a whole year, a little over a year to fill up, and we basically broke even in year one. Not broke even, but in our operating budget, broke even. We are not able to pay back the loan of startup, so you know, we're not breaking even.
Well, I think that kind of goes to our model isn't necessarily predicated on having X number of students the minute you open the door. Mm-hmm. The goal is to get to X number of students after 2 or 3 years. I know we reference a promissory note in here. The initial budget shows a $600,000 drawdown on that promissory note, but the promissory note will go up to $1.5 million. So again, there is financial flexibility in getting the school or schools up and running to their sustainable levels.
So just to clarify, going back to the question about the growth plan and the additional site. So in this first year, you're planning to open one site and then eventually have a second site in year two and then a third site in year three?
Yes.
But so when you're looking at, let's say, the year two,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, go. Okay. Yeah.
When I'm going in year two and we're looking at the number of students of 600, we're talking about two centers that each would have approximately 300 students in each.
Yes.
Yes, we have more than 300 at a site.
Okay. Do we have any other? So you now have 5 minutes to make a closing statement to the panel. As a facilitator, I will cue you when you have 1 minute remaining and when the finance is. So you may begin.
Bill, do you want to do our closing?
Yes, I will. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for your consideration. We look forward to fulfilling our mission to improve graduation rates and to empower the students in Central East Phoenix by providing them with a successful educational experience to prepare them for a highly competitive world that they will enter. The charter principals and founders represent diverse individuals have a deep interest in serving at-risk students. We bring this extensive experience in education, workforce development, and the organizational development, including finance. The collective experience will serve the Fifth Arrow School with excellence. Our innovative blended learning model works, and we hope to put it to work for Phoenix, Arizona, and its young people. Thank you for your consideration and time.
Thank you. To conclude the in-person interview, I'll describe what will be happening next. The technical review panel will evaluate the scores from the review of your written application package, as well as the findings of the interview panel. This will include whether your written application met the scoring criteria specified in the application and whether the interview panel finds sufficient capacity to operate a charter school. Next, the recommendation report will be submitted to board staff and will be presented to the board at the December 14, 2015 meeting. This will be a full day meeting that will begin at 9 a.m. If you have any questions about next steps, please contact Tracy Esposito, and I have her card and I'll give that to you. Once again, the Arizona State Board for Charter Schools, the technical review panel, and board staff would like to thank you for coming in today and for your interest in providing quality educational choices to the children of Arizona. And I know that most of you are from California, I assume, so have safe travels for those.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.